We've got an awful lot of ground to cover today before we send you back out into the field. So I wanted to get a sense from you of what you're taking away or what you took away from yesterday's class. So let's just go from, you know, around, and I'd like to know what stuck with you yesterday. What's the single most important thing you took away from yesterday's session? Anne?
Well, I would say two things. One on kind of each end of it, on the editorial side, the thinking about the story arc and the, you know, overriding theme of what you're doing and how that can change over time and that's okay.
Okay.
And then
we're going to talk about a lot more about that today. As a matter of fact, I'm going to show you a film and we'll discuss how these story arcs change, how you recognize these story arcs, how you figure out, you know, how you not only pre-visualize, but once you see these things and recognize them, you learn how to cultivate them.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's a lot of what you're going to be doing today.
And I think the other thing on the technical side is getting up and down, you know, bending your knees and getting down on the floor, climbing up on stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we all saw it makes a big difference when you remember to do that.
It's exhausting, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's an intellectual challenge and it's a physical challenge. A lot of people don't figure this out. Okay, good. Anne? Karen?
I think what I took away from it was the need to really have those compelling images, really looking for all those various six sequence shots, like you said, taking the close-up, the extreme close-up, and then how can you look at that from a different angle? Can you do the medium shot? And the,
right. One thing I want to make sure that everybody understands, you know, this six-shot system, when it works, it's fantastic. You know, I did a piece, and if we have time, I'll show it to you today, of a cigar factory in Cuba, in Havana, last year.
Oh,
and you know, you've got a stationary situation there. You've got a couple of hundred people doing the same thing over and over and over again, repetitive action, and it lends itself extremely well to that system. That's where the six-shot system really, really works. We saw a chain gang yesterday, and we saw the guys in the courtyard. We talked about this briefly yesterday, and I had the luxury of the time to be able to go with three or four of those people and do the six-shot system with them. But a lot of times, it just doesn't work. And you've got to recognize, you know, okay, the six-shot system is not going to work here, but if you're conditioned to look for those six different perspectives, it'll help you even when the whole system doesn't work. So you'll get those different shots as opposed to everything from up here, you know, wide angle shot, which is not very compelling at all, right? Sometimes the six shot system works wonderfully, and sometimes you just have to follow the action and forget about that system, all right? Rhett, the most important thing you learned yesterday, please.
Maybe what not to do. I think I need a lot less talking as people talking to the camera. I'm going to look for some more compelling shots today. Let me see. I think I could have used an assistant yesterday, so I'm looking forward to that.
You could have used what, sorry?
An assistant, you know.
Okay.
Because I'm collecting audio separately from the video that I'm shooting, and it's kind of juggling too much. So.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Kalpana?
Yes. I think what I saw was the power of imagery. I mean, yesterday we had such incredibly powerful images that we saw. But also, I mean, I think the whole thing of what is the story when you're dealing with so many different visuals, such a lot of visual stimuli all over the store. There was so much going on visually and otherwise. That it was hard to, I mean, you really have to sit down and think of what the story really is and to find images and things like that that kind of go together to tell a compelling story out of it all. It almost seems like it could go in any different direction, but this thing of trying to sort of contain it so that it's one cohesive story.
Yeah.
I think that can be a challenge.
As we talked yesterday, you know, one of the things that you guys have to learn to do is to really walk into a place and to deconstruct what you're seeing there, understand, articulate what you're seeing, what are the visually defining characteristics, who are my characters here, what's the story I want to tell, seek out any dramatic arcs. Once you recognize them, cultivate them, you got to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and then you can put these things together and make story. I'm going to show you a film today before I send you back out about dramatic arcs, and this is the thing that I want you guys to be looking for today when you go out there, okay? Chad?
I would say the biggest thing I learned was that less is more when it comes to shooting, and that it's way better to have a few really good shots and, you know, 30 minutes of that than 3 hours of just a bunch of, like, fanning around with a camera.
Okay.
When you go back and look at it on your computer, it's just much more usable and much more manageable. The 20-second shot thing, very helpful. Line it up like a still.
Right, right.
Camera, right. And then shoot.
This seems to have resonated a lot with you. You know, the idea of framing your shot, deciding right. What you want to shoot. Okay, I want to do this, right?
Right.
Then hit the record button. You know, I've been doing this stuff for years and years now, and I still count in my head, 1, 2, 3. Right. Every shot that I make, I count.
And then out, as opposed to leaving it going, hey, here right. We go, we're walking around.
Then you hit the pause button, okay. And then you go, okay, then you reframe, right. You know, recompose the picture, then you hit the record button again, 1, 2. Right. Three. I do this all the time, and I've been doing this forever.
Right.
You know?
So I thought it was like, okay, here we go. We're making a documentary. And just walking.
No.
It's not usable.
You're making still pictures. If you look at some of the most compelling pictures that you've ever seen, the movies that you've ever seen, or documentaries, and you turn the sound off, if you analyze the stuff, and you look at it and you say, okay, here's a still shot. Mm-hmm. There's stuff moving in it. Here's another still shot. There's stuff moving in it.
Exactly.
They're not going around like this with the camera.
Right.
You know, there's still shots that move inside of them. And they put these together and they edit them so that they move and you know, it creates, you know, think of Psycho. Remember the shower scene in Psycho?
Yeah.
If you go back and look at that, the camera almost never moves.
Mm.
They're all still shots. And you never ever see the knife touching the victim. You never see that. All of it's implicit. By the way, if you haven't seen the movie Psycho that just came out, it's actually quite fun. You should go
but,
see
but
it.
My thing is, a few of those good ones is way better than hours of that other crap.
Yeah, you don't need the crap.
You don't need it.
You don't need 5 hours to make a 3-minute piece. Ivan?
Yeah, I think the same thing that he was highlighting, you know, to memorize the 6-shot system.
Okay.
Because particularly me, you know, I don't have it in my mind, right? When I go there that I need a wide angle, I need a stream close-up, I need a close-up, and all that stuff. Because that gives the dynamic, you know, in the timeline.
Yeah.
Just when you see it, then, you know, that's
okay.
The way to.
The assistance yesterday, I want to know if you guys have anything that you want to point out that you noticed yesterday that we should talk about briefly. Brad?
Give me a few minutes to think about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mine would be fix whatever the problem is. So if you're shooting and there's something wrong, fix it. Instead of going, I don't know, or I feel embarrassed, or something's wrong. Sometimes it's embarrassing and you have to kind of screw it up and go, but you just, like you noticed me with Bill yesterday, sometimes I'll go, you need to move in a little bit, because you're always thinking the final footage, what am I gonna finally have? I need that to work, or my client needs to pay for it. This has to work, so if it's wrong, just because I'm embarrassed, going to be really bad when it's fine. So just take up your courage, just adjust. The mic is wrong, you know, it's hitting some jewelry, or, you know, the light is in the back. I know we had that happen yesterday with the light and the pole. You know, Coppola had a really good lesson when he came out to cut the lamb. You know, the pole was right there, you know. So you kind of have to go through those exercises going, okay, no more pole shots in the middle of things. So just feel free to, you know, there's a wire hang, whatever it is, just fix it so you get the best shot that you can. So
it's a very good point. I think that, you know, these people give you time. They allow you into their lives because they ultimately want these projects to be successful. Mm-hmm. These guys don't give you 20 or 30 minutes for an interview because they have 20 or 30 minutes to burn up for nothing. They generally do not, right? So your obligation is toward them to make this project be successful. And the only way they can be successful, if you wrap your arms around the thing and take control of it and say, okay, we're going to do this right. So if you find, like, in the middle of an interview that something looks wrong, something is not working, stop, fix it, and move along, okay, so that it is successful.
So
Brad?
Two things, yeah. So Ben and I, for example, yesterday, we're dealing with some technical issues. And I would just say, don't let the technical issues get in the way of the process that Bill is trying to teach. We've all suffered with technical issues. I think no one has had a clean shoot. And that's part of the process, and it's part of the learning curve. And those are elements that you can master. What's important is to learn about to focus on the story, finding the character, the narrative arc, the character development. And I think there was a wide range of characters as well. Ben and I were in the field and had a very compelling main character and focused on him. Others, I think, were struggling with finding a character. So,
yeah.
You know, fill in the gaps where you need to fill it in. If you have a lot of really good material, but you haven't found a central character, you know, you got to find that character. I think, Chad, you had a woman yesterday that talked for pretty much the entire time.
Yeah, she was an excessive central character.
Right. So, but there's a lot of stuff that, there's a lot of really good material in what she said, but you now know what other pieces you need to fit in, you know, to sort of expand that out and to cover it. So just find, you know, focus on what pieces you're missing, what you did well. I mean, everybody, I think, did a lot of really good work yesterday.
Yeah.
It's not an easy process. It's a very steep learning curve. So stick with it. Stay positive. Don't get frustrated. Push through it. Find character. And story and character trump everything always.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, story and character cover.
I just had another thing to add about this whole focusing on the technical aspects, because I know that I was focusing, for instance, on filming one bit, and I was counting in my head to 20, whereas there was this really interesting action that happened. There was this woman carrying this whole, you know, platter of bread who walked past me, and I was so focused on this 20-second count that I totally missed this incredible piece of action.
Yeah.
And I thought this whole thing of trying to shoot with your eyes in different directions, almost one through the eyepiece and the other at the action, is a tremendous challenge, but a great skill to learn.
Yeah. You know how you resolve this tension between trying to get those six shots and follow the action. You know how you do that?
No.
You know how you resolve it? It's practice. You just go out to the field and you work.
Yeah.
That's all, and soon it becomes second nature, and you find yourself moving from shot number three, going, oh, there's a woman with the bread.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And those six shots don't have to be in any order. You know, they can be, but once that system is embedded here, then it becomes second nature to you. You go out and it just happens, And that's when it's like learning a new language. When I first started to learn Spanish many years ago, I understood the language and I spoke the language. I was fluent in the language when I started to dream in Spanish.
Wow.
I started to dream in Spanish and I go, I got it. This stuff will come to you like at 4:30 in the morning sometime and you'll say, I got it. Yes.
The thing that I do to kind of remind all that is I have a little cheat sheet that's in my camera bag with the six shot system, or check your battery, check your mic, check the thing. And I read it before I go on every shoot. I just, because you just don't remember it after a while. So I just kind of, okay, got it. Am I all set? And you refresh your memory with it. So I just pull it out. It's what are my settings going to be on the light and that kind of thing. So it makes a big difference. It kind of helps you be consistent.
That's a perfect segue to this, Bruce. Thank you very much. This is my shooting tips, okay? Wait, don't shoot. It's like, these pilots, every time a pilot gets into a plane before he or she takes off, it's like, okay, let's go through this checklist. They might have had 1,000 flights, but you know what? They still go through the checklist. So this is your checklist. On the back of this thing is the white card. Here's your white balance, okay? You can put this in your backpack and you're ready to go.
Oh, here you go.
You'll stay clean too, that's a good one.
So you just follow this stuff, and it's okay. On your way to the, to do the interview, on your way to do the shoot, turn off the radio, forget about, your date, the previous night, whatever. Go through this stuff in your head. Or when you get there, go through this stuff and you'll be more prepared to shoot than you were otherwise, okay? Pull out your, if you have your manual, your field manual nearby, please. Could you go to page number 25? There is a proposal there about halfway down the page. It's called Images of a Revolution. It's a proposal that I handed an executive producer at Now on PBS a number of years ago, 10 years ago, because I pitched a story to him.
What page?
25, bottom of page 25. It's much longer than most proposals should be, but I wanted this guy to have a sense of all the components of what I wanted to do. Take 2 minutes and read that thing, please, and we'll talk about this paper progression from proposal controlling idea, title, onto script, treatment, and so forth. This is the beginning. This is the beginning of this paper trail, of this conceptual trail that you guys are in right now. You guys, you know, and I will keep asking you guys the same question, what does this thing look like?
Well, the way you're presenting it here, I'm seeing you pull something from what you did before.
Right, right.
And showing, moving fast forward and showing, perhaps even starting in the same stance, the same place.
The background of this piece is the following. In 19, I think it was 88, something like that, a Canadian documentary crew made a documentary called The World Is Watching. It was about the Western media and how the Western media covered the Contra War in Nicaragua, okay? The film was very, very successful. It's used in journalism schools all around the country. And in 2002, they approached me again. I was in the film. I was part of the original documentary. 2002, they approached me because they were making a sequel to the original The World Is Watching film, and the sequel is called The World Stopped Watching. So, you know, I said, sure, I'll go down and we can, you know, my storyline would be perhaps we'll take my book. So I pitched this story to Now on PBS so that, you know, when we went down there and they did this piece about me looking for some of the people who were in my original book of photographs that I published in 1987, you know, we could follow that storyline. And through the prism of a handful of characters, we'd discuss, we'd present the Nicaragua of today and what's happened since the time 20 years previous that I made those pictures of may I see the book? Can you hand me the book there, please?
I'm kind of curious what are your shots besides the interviews between the beginning and the end shot? I get that, you know, the eyes of the woman
right
at the funeral, the eyes
right
of the woman today.
Right.
Well, the whole dramatic arc is about me. You know, we sent some of the, what we did was we scanned some of these pictures from this book and we actually published them in newspapers in Nicaragua. And we said, if you know these guys, call up our producer at such and such a telephone number and tell us where they are. And the phone started to ring off the hook. Right? So my dramatic arc, my storyline, and I'm just one of a handful of journalists who they follow both in the original film and in the sequel to the original film, my storyline is, okay, how I went back to Nicaragua after you know, 20 years after I made some of the pictures in this book, and how I sought out these people, how I found some of these people, and what's happened to their lives, and how that, you know, how their stories embody what's happened to the country. Again, you know, we talked yesterday about the best way to tell stories is through the prism of one person. In this case, a handful of people through which people can extrapolate, viewers can extrapolate a broader story. So that was the whole idea behind this piece. But, it, you know, talk to me a little bit more about how this thing reads, how this proposal reads. And what comes to mind when you read this thing? Is it different from other stuff that you read?
Well, it has a point of view.
Okay.
And I think that you know, many Americans would immediately find it engaging because it's you're reminding us that the consequences are our responsibility.
Okay.
So we have an immediate connection with this other country that people have forgotten about.
Okay. Yeah.
It's all visual, isn't it?
Visual language, yeah.
I'm telling the people, I work in this, and this is our medium. You know, so I have to tell people, this is what you're going to see. And this is what you're going to hear. John Seiseloff, the executive producer of Now on PBS, who I sent this to, who I knew in Nicaragua years ago, wants to know, when I pitch a story idea, he wants to know what this thing looks like here. You know, the theme is kind of secondary, right? The subject matter is almost secondary. He wants to know what it's going to look like. So in my proposal, I have to tell him what this thing is going to look like. That's my controlling idea. You know, it has to be built around this, you know, the visuals of my idea. So I have to tell them, this is what it's gonna look like, this is what it sounds like. So that treatment is gonna run through my proposal, it's gonna run through my definition of controlling idea, it's gonna run through the script that I write, it's gonna run through the treatment that I write, and it's gonna finally embody itself in the final product. Let's see this piece now. It's only like 7 minutes long, and it'll give you a sense of you know, how a proposal is matched with the finished product, how, you know, I have an idea of who the characters are going to be, but you know what? We go to the field and things aren't the same that you think they're going to be. I did a lot of research. I knew some of these people years ago, but when we went to the field, something happened.
Okay? This is a proposal or a treatment?
This is my proposal.
Okay.
I proposed, I sent this to John Sisoloff, who is executive editor at Now on PBS at that time. And he said, okay, this sounds interesting. Let's talk about money.
And the treatment comes later.
Treatment comes later. Your proposal is your statement of intent. Your script, which is a shot-by-shot and a clip-by-clip description, it's the roadmap to your final piece. You should be able to hand your script to an editor, and that editor who sits in front of the Avid machine or whatever machine he's using, whatever program, should be able to, it's a paint-by-numbers description. Yeah. All the number sixes are blue, all the number fours are yellow, all the number tens are green, whatever. And he or she fills in those spaces, and all of a sudden, you've got a picture. That's what a script is. The treatment, unlike the statement of intent, this treatment is a very, very visual description of what you actually have as a result of your work in the field. It's not like what you want to do. This is what I want to do. This is what I intend to do. But when I went to the field, guess what? The reality wasn't quite what I thought it was going to be. But I had a clear idea of what I wanted to do. So, you know, it was easier for me to pivot and go in another direction because I knew the landscape already. If you don't know the landscape, if you don't do your research, and you go out into the field, then you're lost.
Yeah.
And you have there's no roadmap, there's no plan. You're kind of like, you know, a man with a blindfold on bumping around in the woods, right? If you have a plan, if you pre-visualize what you're gonna do, if you understand what the visual capabilities and the story, the storytelling possibilities are, you can change course in the field without losing a tremendous amount of time, okay? So let's see what this thing looks like. And again, you know, it's all about character. It's all about the relationship between, you know, this document here, your proposal, your story idea, and how it turns out in the field. There are a lot of teaching points in this thing. It's about 7 minutes long.
The potential threat to our national security. Take a look at this film. Carlos Gomez lives a life without enemies now. He drives his own bus. He has a wife and 3 children. But when we first met nearly 20 years ago, Carlos was a soldier. He had lots of enemies. And one day, they nearly killed us both.
What am I giving you there?
You put yourself in the story.
I put myself in the story, but there's really no information there, is there? I'm not giving you data. I'm not giving you statistics. I'm not telling you about the history of Nicaragua. I'm not talking really about the Contra War. But I did something more important than all that stuff. I didn't back up in your front yard with a dump truck of information and go, woo, boom, did I? But the intent certainly was to engage you, to hook you in within the first, what is it, 7 seconds of this piece, though? It's actually more like 20-some seconds. But I hope you're engaged. You may stick around. You know, one day they nearly killed us both. What is this guy talking about? I got you thinking, I hope. So now I'll back into the story. Okay, now I'll give you information.
Carlos and I met in 1985 in the dark days of Nicaragua's Contra War. He was a medic in the Sandinista Army. I was a photographer for Newsweek. We were on a routine patrol on Nicaragua's Atlantic coast. Me with a camera, Carlos with an AK-47 assault rifle. This is the Simón Bolívar Battalion, the toughest, the best of the Sandinista Army. I felt safe with them, nearly invincible. Until that morning, when the jungle exploded and men began to bleed, we had walked right into a Contra ambush.
We never thought they would surprise us there. We were careless. We never imagined they would surprise us. All the bandages they have on, I put them there.
The wounded were evacuated on stretchers made of poles and their own hammocks. I followed them back to base at the nearby town of Mulukuku. There, local peasants led me to a little plastic hut and a scene that is hard for me to look at even today. A Sandinista militiaman recently killed by Contras, lying in his casket. With him was his family, his wife, his father, his mother. It was like they were saying, tell the world what is happening here. Tell them of our loss, our sorrow. That's exactly what I was trying to do, first in the pages of Newsweek, later in the pages of my book of photographs. I lived in Nicaragua during the 1980s, at the height of the U.S.-sponsored Contra War. Now I've come back to find the places and the people printed in my book and imprinted on my life. I want to see what's happened to this country that America said was vital to its national security. I want to find out, what was all that loss and sorrow for? I set out for Mulukuku to find the family of the dead soldier. Heading north from Managua, the road falls apart. Even during wartime, I remember the highways were in better shape than they are now. Along the way, I see children filling the holes and ruts that scar the road. Their pay is an occasional tip from grateful passersby. As I get closer to Mulukuku, there's hardly a road at all. The town hasn't changed much since I was here 17 years ago.
Do you see what just happened there? You see what just happened? I mean, this stuff goes by us and we don't think about it, we don't recognize it, but you've got to learn how to recognize this stuff, you know, when it starts or before it starts, so that you can construct these dramatic arcs, you can cultivate them, and you can have a beginning and a middle and an end. We have a story within a story here, and it's all about this little journey, isn't it? I knew we were going to go up to the mountains. The challenge was to find some of these people. They're up in the mountains. So I have to shoot the beginning of the piece, it's as simple as sticking the camera out the side of the car, shoot the highway, right? The highway falls apart. By the time we get to the mountains, it's a dirt road with mud puddles. Along the way, we see the kids, you know, filling up the holes so the people will throw them tips out the window. But you have to see this stuff before it actually happens. You know you're going to go on a journey, so you know that this journey is going to have a beginning, it's going to have a middle where the kid, you know, is repairing the road, and it's going to have an end when we arrive at Mulukuku. Right? This is a dramatic arc. These are the things that keep audiences compelled and watching. Because the question is, okay, this guy's going to go up from the mountains to find these people. The obvious question is what, Karen?
What's he
going to
find there?
Are they going to get there? What they're going to find there? Are they going to have any problems going up there? You know, it's not, there's not a hell of a lot of drama or tension wrapped into this thing, but there's some level of suspense, and you've got to learn to put these things into your stories so that you can, you know, inject that suspense, inject that question into your stories, and keep these things moving by doing that. So here's the end of that little mini story.
Years ago, but everything has changed for Aurora Harkin, the mother of the fallen Sandinista soldier. I found her less than a mile from where I made the photograph so long ago. Seeing the picture in my book opened up old wounds.
Yes, these are all my people.
She told me about her son.
5 days after he left, they brought him back dead to Mulukuku.
The boy's death crippled her family. Then grief ripped it apart. Her husband was first to go.
About 4 months later, we were divorced because I spent all my time in the house crying, and he would come home and get mad at me and yell at me. And that just made me worse, so it was better that we got divorced because I couldn't stand the pain of losing my son.
One of her other sons left for a nearby town. Her daughter-in-law, the dead soldier's wife, was next.
Zulema Garcia.
She was heartbroken, and she went home with her children to her father in the mountains.
64 years old now, Aurora sells tortillas from her house to support herself. She is alone except for the youngest of her 5 children and her memories. This is the first time she's ever seen a picture of her son as he lay in his coffin.
I will guard this as if it were the eyes on my face.
The men who killed Aurora's son were called Contras. They were denounced by international human rights organizations. The Sandinistas called them mercenaries and beasts. But this was during the Cold War, the 1980s, and the Contras were America's surrogate against communism. President Ronald Reagan supported them, called them freedom fighters, and compared them to America's founding fathers. During the war, I photographed both Sandinistas and Contras. Now that I've returned, I want to know the men, not just the labels. A woman in Mulukuku identified one of the Contras in my book. She alleged this man had participated in an ambush that killed civilians. I decided to try and find him. I had to pass through the northern mountains, the heart of darkness of the Contra War. It's where I spent most of my time covering the conflict, where I saw roads turn into minefields, farms into free fire zones, hamlets into cemeteries. This is coffee-growing country, but the bottom has fallen out of the international coffee market. Here, whole families harvest the beans for a few dollars a day, even less than they made during the war.
Siriaco. ¿Qué tal?
After a six-hour drive from Murucucu, I found the man I was looking for. Siriaco Tercero was at home outside the northern town of Ocotal. He said he couldn't quite remember me, but when I showed him my book, he found this picture and one of his four brothers who had joined the Contra forces with him. When I see this picture again, I feel the excitement, the exhaustion, and the fear of a one-month march through the jungle. Siriaco spent 8 years as a Contra soldier tromping through the northern highlands. His targets, he says, were Sandinista soldiers, not civilians.
All of us were peasants, all of us Nicaraguans, who simply didn't like the repression and were forced to take up arms to defend ourselves.
2 decades later, the will to fight seems a distant memory.
I lost most of my youth during the war. I lost the opportunity to work. If we hadn't had a repressive government that forced us into the mountains to fight, maybe the country would be different today. Maybe we wouldn't be living in poverty today.
Siriaco said all he ever wanted to do was work his land, make a family, and be left alone. And he has achieved that.
We are poor but content, because at least I'm not being hunted down by anybody, and I can work in peace and take care of my children.
Like Siriaco, Carlos, the former Sandinista medic, still believes in what he fought for, because, he said, the revolution promised to bring a better life for the majority. But after tens of thousands of deaths, after the disruption of a generation of young lives, Nicaragua has moved back in time, back to the oligarchs who control the ranches, the big farms, the factories. The revolution and the counter-revolution are over.
It's really sad. It's something that hurts, but it's the truth.
In Managua, what I see now is more poverty, more unemployment, more inequality. The earth, which received the blood of so many, is now owned by the very few. As I photograph Nicaragua once again, I see how the lives of Carlos, Aurora, and Siriaco, the whole generation that survived the war, survives still, one day at a time.
What struck me about that so sadly is that many of the wealthy families in Nicaragua fled during the Contra-Sandinista War, moved to Miami, waited out the war. When the war was over, went back, and now they're back in control again.
So let's go to this thing now. You know, what's the intent? What was the intent of the piece? The intent of the piece, describe it. What was my controlling idea? What did I want to do with this thing, Karen?
You wanted to show basically how different the life had changed, gotten worse, actually.
Okay.
What I liked in there was you kind of laid the foundation for what you were going to reveal to us. I mean, as you were showing that the road was getting worse.
Right.
That also, like, foretold.
Kind of a symbol of what.
I liked how that mirrored, because it was setting it up in me. Okay.
Yeah. But fundamentally, I wanted to give you guys information about Nicaragua and what had happened or not since I worked there and photographed these people for Newsweek, right? And I could write down the statistics, the data, all the stuff, and give it to you and you know, read it to you, or have someone read it to you, or stand in front of a chart and give you all the numbers. But it's not very effective delivery of information. So what I did is I packaged it in these three characters, you know, the former soldier, the former Contra, and this woman, packaged it in that. And my intent was, the proposal said, I wanted to do a story about the mother who is breastfeeding the fallen militiaman's child. But she was way up in the mountains. She was not available. We didn't have time to go. You know, it would take 2 days to walk there. And if we found her, we'd be lucky. If she was still there, who knows? So it's kind of a sleight of hand. You know, I want you to understand what happened to Nicaragua in those years that went by since I made the pictures in this book and since we revisited the country. What I did was I didn't hide the information, but I tucked the information. I wrapped the information around the stories of these three people. Who embody, I think, a broader experience. That's what I want you guys to understand about how you use characters, okay? And how your proposal, your statement of intent, how it differs sometimes than what ultimately is going to be the piece. This is different from what I proposed, you know? But, you know, I adapted in the field. I didn't know where we were going to find this guy. I didn't know that a woman was going to be standing there and go, hey, this guy tried to kill me. I was in an ambush. He killed like 40-some people, this guy. I didn't know we were going to see that. I had no idea. I didn't know that we were not going to be able to find the mother who was breastfeeding the child, right? But you adapt in the field. I had a clear idea what we can do. We did it.